Hello, and welcome to Data Today, brought to you by Zulka. I'm your host, Dan Klein, and I look after everything data and AI at Zulka. We're living in a world of opportunities, but to fully realise them, we have to reshape the way we innovate. We need to stop siloing data, ring-fencing knowledge, and looking at traditional value chains. And that's what this podcast is about. We're taking a look at data outside the box to see how amazing individuals from disparate fields and industries are transforming the way they work with data, the challenges they're overcoming, and what we can all learn from them. In season two, we're exploring how we can use data to save the world, from helping people discover their history to combating fake news. We're going to be covering a lot of ground. According to Alzheimer's Disease International, the number of people around the world with the condition will reach 78 million in 2030 and 139 million by 2050. As of 2024, there is no known cure for Alzheimer's, dementia, or other similar degenerative brain conditions. However, what we do have is a large data set of patients who have undergone cognitive tests over multiple decades. Rhoda Au is Professor of Anatomy and Neurobiology, Neurology and Epidemiology at Boston University, and also Director of Neuropsychology at the Framingham Heart Study. Rhoda describes herself as being interested in what people aren't doing. In the late 1980s, this is exactly what led her to Alzheimer's research as a field. She saw an untapped opportunity to further our understanding and break new ground.
So because I came from a field that was different than the one I entered into professionally, one of the things that I was struck by when I first entered was how naive I thought our conceptualization of the brain was and how crude I thought our assessment tools were. So I actually started thinking like, wow, we need to find a better way. And I've been on that path for actually my entire career, because as a neuropsychologist, I'm very interested in how do we assess people's cognition accurately. And the tools that I was given, the tools of the trade, I didn't think were adequate given how heterogeneous the behavior is. Like, we know this. We don't need to be a scientist to know this. We know that we have good days and bad days when it comes to things like our memory and our executive function. We even have better moments and worse moments even within a given day. So the fact that now suddenly I'm given these tools, I'm asked to go in and test people who, by the way, are pretty anxious when you go in to test them. So already they're not likely to be at their peak performance. I give it to them one time, and then I say, well, from this, I'm going to assess your cognition. And I'm also seeing a whole range of people. I'm seeing people who are not native speakers of English, and many of these tests were developed that way. They're not necessarily from westernized cultures. They're not necessarily highly educated because a lot of these tests are biased toward education. All I could think of was there are so many limitations to these tools, and we have to figure out not how to fit our science into our methods, but start to rethink how do our methods need to fit the science. And that's really what took me to where I am today.
So circa 1990, what are we talking? Are we talking survey tools and are we talking question answer stuff? We're not talking collecting data per se. We're recording question and answer with said patient on a specific day. Is that that's the gist of where these tools are in the 1990s, is it?
Yeah, there were paper and pencil tools. So I would ask you a question, right? I might read you a paragraph, for instance, and ask you to tell it back to me. And then 15 minutes later, I'll ask you to tell it back to me again. Or I might ask you to repeat some words that I just said. And now can you repeat what I said in backwards order? We give them all these different questions. And here's what's really interesting when you're doing testing. Is there's the response that is considered, quote unquote, the correct response, right? So presumably you're looking for that correct response. And all you pay attention to is, did they give you a correct response or did they give you an incorrect response? So you either mark it correct or you give them a zero because it's incorrect. That's typically how we think about tests. But when you give these tests, it turns out that people will give you all sorts of responses. They'll give you a correct response, they'll give you incorrect responses, or they'll just give you some extraneous response. And it's all those other responses that bring a richness that you need to think about and not just pay attention to the final response. So I always like to say in an incorrect response, not all zeros are the same. There are levels of incorrectness, right? So you could give an incorrect response that was close to the correct response, but not quite there. Or you could give a response that's totally out of left field. And yet we score those the same way.
So what kind of patient sample sizes are we talking about in the early 90s?
When I started at the Framingham Heart Study, which was in 1990, and this has been a study that's ongoing since 1948, we had thousands of participants. So that's the size of which I'm testing. And because of the crudeness of the tools, it actually takes lots and lots of people, testing lots of people, to start to detect differences between people who are, say, cognitively intact versus those who are in the early stages of going down that precipitous decline because of a neurodegenerative disorder like Alzheimer's disease. So that's what I was really struck by, is that sometimes we were calling people who are cognitively intact based on their score, even though I thought that they may not be, because I'm listening to all these other extraneous responses, right? And then there are people who might have gotten an incorrect response, but I think that they're perfectly okay, because I think that there's extenuating circumstances that are leading to these incorrect responses, and it's not because they have some pathological situation going on in their brain. So that's the challenge that's in front of you, is that you see this whole range and you're trying to figure out how to capture it. And actually what took me down the path where I am now, which is really in the digital realm, the whole reason I got involved with that is because of this. I was listening to all these responses that people were giving. I'm testing hundreds and hundreds of people, and across our team, we're testing thousands, and we're missing all this information. We're like not paying attention to it. What happened was, is I realized I want to score that information. I want to make all these extra responses data. And I'm not the first, actually. This way of thinking about how to look at neuropsych performance, neuropsychological test performance, is actually called the Boston Process Approach. And so I was adopting some of the work that people have been done clinically, and really the person who championed this at the time was Edith Kaplan. And so she was teaching this in a clinical realm, but it's very difficult to implement in the research realm. But I decided we need to bring it into research and we need to bring it in a large scale.
I love the distinction you've made between the information that you need and the data that you're able to collect. That's a very important distinction in my world. If we come forward now, how have things developed in the last 30 years? When you say you're in digital, what has that done to transform the tools, the size of the patient cohort that you're looking at? What are the changes you've seen in the last 30 years in this space?
So what I did was I started to digitally record people's spoken responses. And that was the way in which I could go back and listen to what they've done and capture it all. Today, the ability to capture digital voice is ubiquitous. And that's because of all the smartphones that are out there, right? So if you think about it, we routinely use the smartphone, and that is a data collection mechanism that's in every person, nearly every person's hand. You're talking about over 6 billion people in the world with a smartphone, over 300 million here in the US. So that is the most penetrating technology in the world, and it makes collecting digital voice really easy. And that completely transforms everything, because it turns out that when we speak, that's a really cognitively complex task. So we're actually now projecting our cognitive capabilities as we're talking. And if I can capture voice, I can analyze that voice. And instead of going to these paper pencil tests to figure out how your cognition is, I can actually analyze your voice. And most people speak. So when we think about how we need to do research that's inclusive of anybody, anywhere, this becomes a really powerful way to do so. And we all do this intuitively. For any of us who've had someone who over time we've noticed that their cognition is changing, you know, we're not going around testing them. We're just going around observing and hearing them. And so when you think about it, when someone is starting to have cognitive problems, their speech is going to change. The words that they use actually become narrower over time because it's harder to find a range of words. They're going to do a lot more pauses, hesitations. They actually will use more words to sometimes to say something because they can't think of the word that they really want.
Being able to track a patient's speech patterns over time is powerful. It's a far cry from the days of pen and paper, that's for sure. A question that often arises when talking about the older generation is they don't like or care about technology. So how are we going to get them to use it? Rhoda thinks that you need to make it worth their while. They've survived a long time without smartphones, so they need an incentive to use them. I agree. I think we often unfairly write older people off because we believe they're technology adverse. However, I would add that their threshold for frustration may be a little lower than the younger generation. Rhoda started collecting voice recordings in 2005 at a time when no one was really looking at this kind of testing method. Nowadays, voice capture is ubiquitous and more questions are being asked about its ethics. So, how does this play into Rhoda's work? What are the ethical considerations that she has to grapple with?
From a research perspective, it's actually pretty significant because what we have to remember is embedded in our voice is our voice print, which is identifying. So one of the challenges right now in moving the field forward from a research standpoint, because in a research standpoint, we do worry about people's privacy and confidentiality, and we want to protect their identities. And so consequently, what's happening is that we're collecting all this digital data, but we're limited in our ability to actually process it because we're limited to whatever we know internally that we've consented for, that participants have agreed to allow our research team. But the problem is that no matter what research team we're talking about, we all have limited capacity, bandwidth, ideas, et cetera, capabilities. And really what we need to do to really accelerate this, to get to the solutions that will really benefit people more immediately, is we have to figure out how to share that data. And so the issue that you bring up in terms of privacy then becomes, did we consent for us to be able to share that? And how do we alter the voice recordings in order to still protect their privacy and confidentiality to get rid of that inherent voice print that is identifying? So those are challenges that we have right now. And those are ones actually that we're working on solving because the ultimate goal is we need to get this data to as many analysts that are out there worldwide in order to get to very interesting solutions because there's no gold standard right now. We have to go through and find it. This is a new area, and a new area of discovery is always a little messy, needs lots of people coming to the table, and then suddenly the solutions that are meaningful will start to emerge. That's not going to come from me. I would love it to come from me, but it's not going to come from me. It's going to come from others who have ideas that are well beyond anything even I would think of. And they're probably going to put us on pathways that are the ones that are going to be the most relevant.
So you have this data set of voices going back 20 years or so, and the data person in me sees this as an amazing training set. However, surely we need to make sure that the person still goes to see the patient. I mean, how's that going to work? We can't get rid of the patient-person relationship entirely.
At the end of the day, when we do a cognitive assessment, that's only one piece of a diagnostic journey. And so what happens is that at best, what we'll be able to do is signal that there's something that's different, that's changed. But there's lots of reasons that could be happening. Could be poor diet, could be stress, suddenly a very stressful situation, right? So it's not necessarily, one, a progressive neurodegenerative disorder, and two, even if it is something, it might be something that's treatable. So I think that's where we need to be careful about understanding what does this provide, which is, I think, a screening tool that will allow you on a very large scale to go out there and screen for lots and lots of different kinds of indicators. And then you need to bring it back to the physician who has to put it together with other information, whether it's from their physical examination, from blood-based biomarkers, from imaging, et cetera. And in that way, they'll be able to put it together to get to a diagnosis, whether it's because you have a neurodegenerative disorder or you have maybe a neuropsychiatric condition, or you might just have literally, you need better lifestyle behaviors because you're not sleeping well, you're not eating well, you know, et cetera.
The patient group that you're talking about is quite a vulnerable category. And it's sort of, in some senses, you're touching on the comorbidity that associated with that group. And you've talked about all the various different tests that you would do. How do you go about analyzing the data when you have comorbidity, you have multiple conditions, you have multiple things going on with a vulnerable patient towards the end of their life? I could imagine that's quite challenging from an analysis perspective. So how does that work?
Yeah, so I like to think from the digital perspective, I like to think about digital as the new blood. So if you think about when we collect blood and you think about that initial tube of blood, which is undifferentiated, it's undifferentiated in terms of what disease biomarkers, and you can take that blood and you can now assay it for whatever different kinds of biomarkers of interest, including ones across different comorbidities, right, from that single tube of blood. Well, it turns out you can do something similar with digital. You can take the digital data streams, and through these data science AI capabilities, you can actually analyze it for different kinds of behavioral symptoms, including things like mental health as well as cognitive behaviors. And so in that way, I think that digital will give you an opportunity in which to analyze that data set into multiple potential comorbidities simultaneously. The big difference between blood and digital is that digital is a non-diluting resource. So you can reanalyze digital infinite numbers of times without diluting it. So you can actually be more aggressive than you can with blood because blood assays change all the time. Well, it turns out that you can do the same thing with digital. You can collect it, you can analyze it for anything that is known, and then you can store it, and then you can reanalyze it when new opportunities for how to analyze it become available. And then because algorithms change, then you can just reanalyze to the most contemporary standard of the day.
If you have any experience with healthcare in Europe or in the UK, then you will know how difficult it is to access your data as a patient. A few news items have brought this to the public attention recently. In the latter half of 2023, for example, the British Medical Association was accused of holding back primary health records of patients who had consented to share them with a large disease prevention study called UK Biobank. Indeed, organisations like Use My Data have been set up over the years to advocate for the increased use of patient medical data in studies and trials. On a more personal level, anybody who's tried to access their patient records or get a copy of a scan, for example, knows how difficult it is to access anything when it comes to their health records. But that's from the EU and UK perspective. I'd love to know how opening up health data to the community influences confidentiality in Rhoda's work.
Currently, you know, keeping in mind that we have to worry about how we share the data in a way that still protects privacy and confidentiality. But what I am particularly interested is finding sort of these open data sharing platforms that allow people, when I say investigators, I mean from multiple different sectors and disciplines. I think it's very important not to think of and get into this mindset of a qualified investigators, because innovation doesn't necessarily come from those within a field. It often comes from people outside of the field. So you want to attract this talent to try to use this data in ways that you have never done before. I think importantly, as you find these data sharing platforms, and I happen to have one that I work with very closely, it's the Alzheimer's Disease Data Initiative. And the reason I chose them is because they're open access. People who make their, and researchers who make their data available to the public, then they provide a platform that anybody can come in a non-proprietary way. And then the other thing that we do is we also use these platforms to share open source processing tools, both in terms of processing the data, de-identifying it in the way that I've talked about is very important to do, and then analyzing it with some of these emerging data science AI tools. So it's really sort of bringing that all together and pushing it out, that we're going to actually accelerate the discovery that needs to happen.
If I now link two conversations together, you've talked about historically holding, let's call it the raw data, for reanalysis at some future date when you've got some new fancy algorithm. How do you balance that storing of the raw and the potential in the 10, 20 years' time for reanalyzing a different way with the reductive nature that comes about when you do something like privacy-enhancing techniques? How do you balance that as a clinician?
Currently, what we're doing is we're actually just trying to develop the tools in which we can process the raw recordings, keep them more or less in their natural state. So that means retaining sort of all the features, all the hesitation, pauses, you know, all the amplitudes, you know, of the voice, et cetera. So we're trying to figure out how can you take that, but then switch the voice itself so that when you alter it, you've essentially changed the tone but kept all the features, so that when the person listens to it, they can still hear all the different acoustic features that you would normally hear, but it's in a tone that's different from the person who produced it. That's what we're working on right now, is how do you retain the raw? How do we use what's now available, state of the art, in order to push this forward and preserve the richness of the raw recording in order to avoid the reductionistic de-identifying processes?
That's interesting. The debate naturally comes to mind here is that around retaining original recording versus altering it and deleting it for privacy reasons, as a clinician, do you not worry around what will happen if technology moves forward and you don't have the original recording? I mean, is that a risk you're prepared to live with?
I think that, like everything, what we're doing today will get a whole lot better tomorrow. So I think that what we're doing is we're setting an example of where to start. And we will document what are the limitations to the way in which we're doing it now. So I guess I'm not concerned in the long run. I understand the limitations in the short term, but I need to, you know, you can't let perfect get in the way of good. Because if I wait around for when that happens, it'll be...
You'll never do the work.
I will never do it, right? So let me start. Let me do the best I can. Let me share it. Let me share it in an open source way, and let me invite the community and say, please help me do better. And I guarantee you, over time, we will get there.
So, final takeaway to leave the audience with and all these data science aficionados who are listening, or just enthusiastic lay people even, what would your final takeaway be for our audience today?
I think that what I'd like people to think about is this concept that innovation, because we often talk about the need for innovation, and it turns out that true innovation is something we've never done before. And we are now moving into this Wild West frontier when it comes to digital. And try really hard not to be bounded by what you know. Take space exploration as your example of where we could be, and use that to center yourself. And I think that would be my biggest takeaway. There's a lot to come. Let's be open for it.
Rhoda believes that if her colleagues want to do responsible research, then they should protect the data they're using confidentially in the way that participants want them to. At the end of the day, volunteers and patients should own their data and be the ones to make decisions about the databases that their data lives in. In the UK and Europe, the majority of diseases that are treated are chronic. We haven't yet been able to work out the balance of longer life and good health. But Rhoda thinks that technology, enabled by more open data sharing, could be the means to the end in this case. Business ecosystems are not new. What is new is that they are becoming increasingly data empowered. To realize complex opportunities, we need innovation beyond boundaries, democratized information, and close collaboration between diverse players. Collaborative, data-empowered, borderless innovation is how we embrace a world of exponential change. Thanks for listening to Data Today, brought to you by Zulka. I've been your host, Dan Klein. For more information on Zulka's work, please visit our website.